welcome back to another episode of Is Fitz Happy? I'm Luke.
And I'm Emma.
And we are doing part two of this chapter, chapter 29 here.
The Convergence.
Yes, we're going to join right back in the middle of Rain's point of view. He had just gotten done talking to Greg about his Althea woes. Greg was going to go to talk to Kendry, the figurehead. But Rain did not want to.
Yeah.
So we'll dive right back into that.
So last time we saw Rain in the previous chapter, he had given up his right to deal with the dragons and the cocoon to Tanglia. Yeah.
Explicitly told his mom that he would not go down into the city without their consent and their approval and their orders to do stuff.
Right. And that he would stop advocating for exhuming the log to see if it would hatch.
Yes.
So now we learn that he actually broke the rules immediately to go say goodbye to Tanglia before he left and to explain what has happened in person and why he gave her up.
Yeah. So as Greg is walking away, he stuffs his hands in his pockets and says, even with gloves on, he would not take a chance on leaning on the railing. The whole ship shouted to him as it was, and it was not Kendry that spoke to him. And he says that the dragon had done something to him because he's traveled on live ships before and nothing had ever happened to this extent. He wasn't sure what or how, but it frightened him. So he goes to visit Tintaglia, and he goes down there and he had begged her to let him go. And Tintaglia had seen how hard he had tried, but instead, she had vowed that she would devour his soul. As long as I am prisoner here, Rain Cupris, so shall you be also, she had cursed him. She had twined herself through his mind like a black vein in marble, mingling with him until he was no longer certain where she left off and he began. It frightened him worse than anything else she had ever done. You are mine, she had declared. As if to underscore her words, the entire floor of the chamber had trembled, and it was a tremor, and he kind of ran to get out of there, but there was extensive damage done to the city, probably.
Right. There is definitely going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a coincidence, or somehow Tanglia was able to rattle the earth?
It's so hard to say in like a book like this.
Yeah.
Because from what I know, I think it's a coincidence, but it just seems like it should be her doing it because it fits narratively, you know?
Fair. Although I don't see how she could.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. Like,
I guess, no. I was going to say maybe you could say that she has some weird control over the silver that is causing the earthquakes, but I don't think the silver is causing the earthquakes. I don't know. We just know that potentially the silver is in the water, making it murky in the rain wilds.
Right. And eating through all the wood that goes in there and people.
So anyway, he had to leave and he talks about how it was actually really scary to be in the chamber because he's never been underground during a quake. Mm-hmm. And how did his dad die? Was that in a quake?
I don't remember. I thought he just got lost in the memories.
Well, I thought he was lost in the memories too, but I thought maybe he got trapped in the mines in some way.
No, I don't, idea.
Maybe I've made up that detail. So anyway, he says it was really scary, but ultimately he was annoyed because there'd probably be a lot of work to excavate anything that had collapsed.
Could hear her laughter echoing as he just ran out for his life. As he fled, he had heard the unmistakable sound of quarters giving way. The deadening rush of damp earth followed the clattering of falling tile. Even when he reached the outside and bent over, hands on his knees, trying to reclaim his breath, he could not stop shaking. There would be work tomorrow, and for days to come. Tunnels and corridors would have to be shored up. If it was bad, sections of the buried city might have to be abandoned. All would have to be expected laboriously before there could be any new explorations. It was precisely the sort of work that he hated. Toil away, the dragon's voice had bubbled merrily in his mind. You might be able to shore up the walls of this dead city, Rain Cupris, but the walls of your mind will stand no more against me or my kind. It kind of brushed off as an idle threat at the time.
Yeah.
But I before we move on to that, I want to quickly touch back on the "you are mine" and her snaking her way into his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that started the process of being an elderling, claiming him as like hers? Maybe unintentionally, and maybe it's just like to curse him and like be in his dreams all the time and like really mess with him. But even if she, like, since that happened, when she's awoken or like born, I guess, they have a connection. And obviously stuff happens between the two of them before, right. Like again, but I think without any other contact, if she's waken up, they have a connection because she forged a connection forcibly with him.
I don't know if it's true, but I am going to say yes, because I really like it, especially with the context of him scratching the back of his neck this chapter, thinking, oh, there's a growth.
Yeah.
Because we know that forming an alliance with these dragons, a bond, it changes you physically. And so, of course, he's getting a growth.
Yeah.
He has become an elderling. I don't know. I like it either way.
Yeah. But anyways, it had seemed like an idle threat to him. The, you know, the walls of your mind will stand no more against me or my kind. Right. So she like opened his mind to all of dragonkind, apparently.
Yeah, which also implies that this is the reason why Kendri is acting different. But I don't, and I mean, maybe, okay, maybe this does go to your theory of he's now an elderling because he's been claimed, and that's why the dragon is reacting to it, because before now there wasn't anything to remember.
Touchstone.
Yeah. And now he's a claimed elderling. And so, and again, Malta, I guess Malta wasn't necessarily claimed already, but kind of. Not in the same way, mm-hmm. but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely something has changed. And Rain talks about that a little bit of, at first he thought, what's the worst she can do? She's already wreaked havoc. And then he realized that actually it's pretty bad.
Yeah. Since then, his dreams had been plagued with dragons. They roared and battled one another. They stretched out on rooftops to sun themselves. They made it atop the lofty towers of an exotic city. He was witness to it all. It was not a nightmare. No, it was a dream of extraordinary brilliance and complexity. They trafficked with beings that were almost human, yet were subtly different. They were tall, with eyes of lavender or copper, and the shades of their flesh were subtly different from any folk he had ever encountered in his real life. His real life. That was his problem. The dreams were far more compelling than his waking hours. He saw cities of the elder kind and came tauntingly close to understanding their history. He suddenly grasped the wideness of their streets and corridors, the broad yet shallow steps, the height of the doors and the generous windows. The vastness of their constructions had been to accommodate the dragons that shared the city. He longed to venture inside the buildings, to linger close to the people as they strolled in their markets, or ventured out on the river in their gaily painted boats. He could not. In the dream, he was with the dragons and of the dragons. They regarded their two-legged neighbors with tolerant affection. They did not consider them peers. Their lives were too short, their concerns too shallow. Rain, while he dreamed, shared that attitude. It was the dragon culture he steeped in, and their thoughts began to color his, not just sleeping, but in waking times as well. And I think that's part of his impatience he felt with Greg as well. It's just like, this is beneath me. Like, stop. I don't care about this stuff.
He has already begun the change, so to speak.
But it goes further than any other elderlings, really, that we see. He's getting steeped in the dragon's point of view, which doesn't happen, really.
Right. Yeah, at least to our knowledge, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I think there definitely is that distinction between dragon and elderling in all the things that we come across, where they can't interact too much. Well, at least for the dragon, because that will affect their offspring, which then brings up the point, is Titaglia not a viable carrier for new dragons because she has spent too much time with humans.
It's hard to say because she was already kind of formed.
But that it doesn't matter. It's the kids that get the elder, or yeah. sorry, the others are created by dragons
who become
too close to humans. Yeah. So
it's true.
I don't know.
We'll have to see. We'll have to wait for another book.
Yeah, if Hob creates a new book, which she is in the works of. So yeah,
we'll see.
If that series touches on dragons at all, we'll find out.
But Rain is kind of in his head talking about how the dragons are just, they feel more deeply than humans. They don't really care about humans because they're gone in the blink of their eye. Their lives pass quickly. And he sees the world with new eyes. Cultivated fields became a patchwork quilt flung across the land. Rivers, hills, and deserts were no longer barriers. So he's seeing the world. He's seeing everything that he wanted. Tintaglia knew him well when she cursed him like this.
Yeah.
And he says the curse of such dreams manifested itself slowly. He awoke unrested as if he had never slept at all. The potency of his other life drew him. He spent his human days in a fog of discontent and restlessness. He regarded his own existence with disdain. A double curse of weariness dogged him. He longed to sleep, but sleep gave him no rest. Yet he desired sleep, not to rest, but to leave his dreary human life behind and immerse himself once more in a draconian world. His life as a man had become a string of weary days. The only thoughts that could still stir his heart at all were thoughts of Malta. And even in those fantasies, he could not shake the dragon's curse, for in his mind's eye, Malta's hair shone like the scales of a black dragon.
I really want to know how the elderlings in the past were able to not drown in the memories or be affected in the way that the people now seem to be affected, because especially with their cities being made from skill, it just seems odd. I mean, I guess where would the record of that be? How would we ever know if this was also a problem? Although I guess we do, because there's that village that's not made with skill across the river from Kelsingra.
Yeah.
So
see, I think a couple thoughts here. One, I don't think that other elderlings experience the same things that Rain is going through. Okay. I think she reached out and said, like, you are mine, and claimed him, and that started the initiation as an elderling. But that was not her purpose in doing that, and mm-hmm. that's not the traditional way to become an elderling. I think that she just lowered the barriers, the natural barriers in his mind, and because of their connection, is sharing some of her thoughts and dreams and things like that. And maybe she did that to torture him, sure. But his mind is no barrier to dragons anymore.
Right.
So he can absorb everything like that. In the past, I do not think that elderlings had the skill.
Okay.
Not in the same way, at least.
Right.
You know, they still made the stone dragons. They still, you know, put themselves into them, whatever. They made things out of liquid skill with their dragon hide gloves. I do not think they had skill the same way that the Farseers do, for example. Because I feel like Fitz was kind of a new thing to Kelsingra. And I know that they were also new to being elderlings, you know, in the last trilogy when he goes there and heals things that, oh, we only thought dragons could do this. I know they're very, very new to that life.
Right.
And fixing things like that. But they've had like 10 years or 15 years or longer to explore a city with a bunch of history in it.
Right.
I feel like they would have encountered something of someone doing something like that.
Right.
You know, maybe not. But I feel like that kind of skill is something that kind of developed over time.
Evolution.
Maybe it evolved from the elderlings in some sort, but I don't think the elderlings themselves had that same propensity or strength of skill that some people have
Okay.
in modern times. Now, this is just headcanon, But that's the way I can kind of explain this out, because Rain seems to be very sensitive to those things because mm-hmm. he was the one looked to decipher things in the city, right?
Right.
By his family. And it seems you need kind of a leaning towards that, or a skill in that, to right. be able to do it. Like, his brother Bendir is not able to do so.
Right.
And that to me implies, since it's such a skill-laden city, that you need some sensitivity to the skill in order to find the memories, or have the memories come to you to interpret what's happening down in the city, to find out the secrets of things, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, Rain is very susceptible or very skill-oriented or has a lot of ability for that, just locked away and hidden behind your mind's natural barriers that we've talked about in the first trilogy. Because yeah. Galen, you know, the whole thing, you have to lower your barriers and able to access it.
Right.
I think Tintaglia just knocked those barriers down.
Okay.
And not that he's necessarily skilling out into the world, but because he doesn't know how to do that.
Right.
She can just filter in and he's absorbing anything around him.
Fair enough.
So I think that's kind of what's happening here.
Okay.
And I think that skill connection, that is what really startles Khentri, because he doesn't want to put his hands on the wood itself.
Right.
It's not even just talking to Khentri. And yeah, I believe it's also like the claiming of the dragon mm-hmm. in addition to it. But that much skill was something that was a being of skill.
Yeah, yeah.
Is just a connection that is probably so out of time for a live ship and a dead dragon.
Yeah.
That it's bringing up those memories.
Okay.
Fair enough. I think that's kind of where he's sitting, and he doesn't know how to explain it.
Okay. That's a good point. I will say the only thing that I'm like a little iffy on is, I just feel like if Rain has the skill, he's not, I don't know how to phrase this, I guess. I feel as though the skill, it doesn't matter how much skill you have if you don't know what it is and how to use it.
Right.
And so, I don't know. I think that's the only thing I'd add to what you're saying, I guess. Is
did everything I said make sense?
But yeah.
I feel like, okay, because I felt like I talked for a long time and I thought I rambled a couple times. So I just kind of wanted to.
It made sense to me. I think it made sense that it just, yeah.
Well, let us know, everybody who's listening in, what you thought of my ramblings. I don't even remember what question sparked that, but let me know what you think, because I like the touchstone of like an elderling, and that's kind of scaring Khentri or Kendry's dragons.
Right.
And I also think it's a lot of the skill there. And like you said, he doesn't know how to use it.
Right.
Doesn't know how to access it. Doesn't fall into a trance ever, really.
What sparked this was me asking why there aren't examples of the people back in the day being like Rain or getting lost in memories.
Yeah, and that's where I forgot to link it back at the end. because I don't think the Elderlings had the same sort of skill, I don't think they had the same immersion into, you know, the memories that modern day people do.
Okay.
I just don't think it affects them as much, because I think they either had like a natural resistance, or they built up that kind of evolutionary necessity, like the traits
right.
able to live in that kind of environment. And I think there are still issues with elderlings that maybe I'm making that up, but in my head, I feel like there are some stories that we hear in the Rainwild Chronicles or something of there still being issues with that sort of thing.
Right.
Could be wrong.
It could also, I guess, be that it seems like the elderlings were a lot more advanced than people were in these days. And so maybe it was a little bit harder to get lost in memories because you could have
like recognition of it.
Yeah. It's not
signs.
As well, not only that, but it's just, it's not as exotic.
Yeah, that's like, fair. Yeah.
It would be like somebody from the Middle Ages being able to peep into our world today or watch a reality TV episode. Like, that's way more interesting than whatever was happening during King Louis IV. Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, of course, somebody's going to want to watch the Real Housewives over being in the Black Plague. Like,
and then the Elderlings walking through is like, oh, that's Glenda. She's just walking to the market.
Yeah.
She's done it every day for 50 years, and that's why her memory's here.
Uh-huh. So, yeah.
I went to her funeral last week, but that's okay.
Yeah, like, oh, I miss her. But it's not like a, whoa, what a magical society. Look at a dragon. I've never seen one of those in real life.
Yeah, it's an everyday occurrence.
So yeah, so mundane. Maybe, like, yeah, it's more mundane. It's less magical, whereas...
That's fair.
This is
more...
Time.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, it's more interesting to be in these dreams and these memories, which, fair. I think, like, even elderlings would be like, this is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think...
from a dragon's point of view all the time.
I'm just thinking Alice would kill for this.
Oh, yeah.
But, no, it's, I don't know, I get it.
It's really effective on Rain, though.
Yes.
This is his dream come true, and yet it is slowly killing him because he's adopted some of those feelings that the dragons have. So he is discontented in his own body, in his own real life, and kind of hates his humanity because of those feelings leaking through from his dreams.
Right. And not only that, but it is a dream come true because he gets to be steeped in the culture that he has been studying. But it's also a nightmare because he doesn't actually get to know about the humanoids that he has been studying his whole life. Yeah. He doesn't get to know the secrets of the city. Mm-hmm. He only gets to know the secrets of the dragons, which is a great trade-off. I would kill to know the secrets of the dragons. However, that is not his main focus. And so the way it's written feels like as soon as he wakes up, he's like, oh, why didn't I pay attention to those people talking? Why didn't I pay attention to what they were doing? Because in the dreams, he is a dragon and dragons don't care.
Yeah. And so, throughout the whole thing, he says that he hears in the background, no more, no more, no more. They are all gone and dead. All the great bright ones. And it is your fault, Rain Cupris. You ended them by cowardice and laziness. You had it in your power to create their world anew, and you walked away from it. That had been the sharpest of his torments. That he had it within his power, she believed, to free her and bring true dragons back into the world. Then he had stepped aboard the Kendry, and his torment took an even more cruel turn. The Kendry was a live ship. The bones of the ship's body were wizard wood. Generations ago, Rain's ancestors had pounded wedges into a great wizardwood log within the crowned rooster chamber. They had split the immense trunk open, and plank after plank of lumber had been sawn and peeled from it. One immense chunk had been taken whole to form the figurehead. The soft, half-formed creature within had been unceremoniously spilled out onto the cold stone floor of that chamber. Rain twisted inside every time he thought of that. He had to wonder, had it squirmed? Had it mouthed airless cries of pain and despair, or, as his brother and mother insisted, had it been a long dead thing, an inert mass of tissue and nothing more than that? If there was nothing of the Cooper's family to be ashamed of, why had it always been kept a secret? Not even the other Rainwild traders knew the full secret of the Wizardwood logs. So he talks about how the city long ago had been parceled out and the rooster chamber had been given to the Cooper's family and thought not very valuable. And it was an accident, apparently, that the wizardwood was found to be resistant to the waters of the Rainwild River, which made them rich.
Right. Well, that also, the accident, quote unquote, is something that Rain is pretty skeptical about. Because what do you mean you accidentally found out that this could be turned into wood that is safe on the water? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but he specifically says in here, an accident had been revealed their unique properties, meaning the logs, or so Rain had always been told. Exactly how that had happened, he had never been able to discover. If any of his living family knew the tale, they had held it back from him.
Yeah,
I'm guessing he kind of thinks it was a secret of the city or something like that.
Why would the city know to use the wizard wood?
Do not know.
I don't know. Anyway,
he's just a paranoid, skeptical guy.
To be fair, I'm a little paranoid and skeptical about that story as well.
Yeah,
there's a lot of questions. But my main question that we can maybe answer is, what happened to the beings in the cocoons? Like, where, there's no way they didn't try to make something out of that, or cut it up into little parts and see what they could use it for.
No idea.
Like, is that the dust that goes in dream boxes? Probably not, because I don't think flesh and bone would... Bone might become dust.
Bone might dust it, yeah. But maybe it is.
I don't know.
No idea.
But also, I'm just thinking about how there's all those rumors that dragon parts can cure illness or whatever, mm-hmm. and I wonder if that's where it stems from.
Black market, you know?
Yeah.
500 years
the
ago
Cooper's
or so.
Family.
Yeah.
Selling dragon parts.
Who knows?
I don't know.
Yeah, this is... I think we've talked about it after our first conversation in the in Ship of Magic, but this is actual book confirmation that the Cooper's family is the sole holders of the Wizardwood Logs.
And their secrets.
But the Wizardwood Logs, because they would sell them to other Rainwild families who would build the ships and sell them to Bingtown trader families.
Right.
So that's how they got their fortune. But yeah, so Rain is kind of rehashing all of this. We've talked about it from his point of view. I think this might be the third or fourth time that he's gone over this. And it's the Cooper's family. What did they do with the creatures on the inside? I could have freed them. I'm so bad.
But also, I think this time we get even more context. So yes, it is rehashed, but we do learn a little bit more detail this time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And get that more sympathetic. I wonder if that picturing of did the creature squirm or gasp for air, is that coming from his newfound kinship with dragons? Is that Tintaglia's thoughts in
might
there?
Might be a little bit of Tintaglia being like, guilt you, yeah. I'll make you guilty, free guilty. Me.
You're guilty.
Yep. I don't know. But he talks more about the Kendry here. The Kendry held nothing back. The figurehead was that of a smiling and affable young man. No one was more knowledgeable about the ways of the Rainwild River. In previous times, Rain had enjoyed many pleasurable conversations with him. Since the dragon's curse had fallen on him, the figurehead could no longer abide him. The smile faded from Kendry's lips. The words died unspoken in his mouth when Rain approached him. The young man's face became not hostile, but apprehensive at the sight of the Rain Wilder. He would regard Rain watchfully, forgetting all conversation. The crew, of course, had noted that, and although none had been so bold as to remark on it, Rain felt pressured not to force the issue and kind of stayed away.
Mm-hmm.
Yet if Kendry felt anxious at the sight of Rain, Rain's emotions ran sharper and deeper, for Rain knew that deep within his fibers, down past the affable face and the handsome young man, there lurked the spirit of a furious dragon. Whenever Rain slept, even if he so much as dozed off in a chair, the buried spirit awaited him. Savagely, the creature mourned the death of all he had once been. He railed at the fortune that had torn away his wings and replaced them with flapping canvas. Instead of talons for seizing prey, he had soft little paws with appendages like wilted tubers. He, who had once been a high lord of three kingdoms, was now confined to the surface of water, pushed about by the wind, ridden with humanity like vermin on a dying rabbit. It was intolerable. He knew it, even if the smiling figurehead did not. Now Rain knew it, too. He knew the spirit that lurked in the bones of the Kendry thirsted for revenge. He feared that his presence on board the live ship was strengthening those buried memories. And he's thinking, like, if those ever break to the surface, what's Kendry going to do?
Yeah.
On whom would that vengeance fall harshest? Rain was terrified the dragon would discover who he was, the descendant of those who had tumbled him unborn from his cradle. So Rain is kind of living in fear and worried about everyone around the Kendry or any live ship
right.
who discovers and has that dragon force its way to the top, which is a nice little foreshadowing for Bolt, who comes up in the future here.
Yeah.
The dragon for Vivacia.
Yes. And I think this is at least our first example so far of a dragon who it is a boy dragon and then a male figurehead, which I find very interesting. I think we got a question about that a while ago of, do we think that the gender of the dragon influences or matches with the gender of the figurehead? And so far, we're one for one.
Yeah.
We'll have to keep watching. I guess Bolt is a female, so Vivacia, that's two. I feel like potentially, and I could be misremembering, but I feel like potentially one of Paragons is female and the other is a male, but I don't remember for sure. So we'll have to wait and see. But that was just something that I noted that this is a male dragon that is Kendry's.
Male figurehead.
Yeah. So we have, this real uneasiness that we're leaving Rain in. And all I can think about is he's still got to go back to the Rain Wilds on a live ship.
Yeah, I know. But we jump over to Cirilla once more, because some time has passed. They were setting up at the beginning of the chapter in part one here.
Right.
The first section of this chapter, they were setting up the return to Bingtown, or I guess the arrival at Bingtown.
Yes, because
Cirilla, her hopes and dreams.
Yeah, Cirilla could see lights in the distance or faintly on the horizon.
Yeah, the night market, she says.
So she knew that they would be arriving to Bingtown the next day.
We get Ronica, of course, having the war bell rung.
Yes.
And now they are here.
They are here.
In the harbor.
But they're not in the harbor. They are, because...
Right, like the entrance to the harbor.
Because the ships are barricading the way in. Because as we know, there's a... Is that an inlet? Is that what it's called?
Bay?
A bay that is...
I don't know.
A half circle bay. And so the entry to that leads into...
There's a bunch
town.
Of live ships across it.
Yes, so they cannot pass. Mm-hmm. You shall not pass.
Cirilla stood on the deck of the ship. Beside her, two stout Chalcedian sailors held the satrap. He was prone on a makeshift litter devised from oars and canvas. The wind had brought a faint reddening to his cheeks. She smiled down on him fondly. "Let me speak for you, Magnadon. You need to conserve your strength. Besides, these are only sailors. Save your words for when you address the Traitor's Council." In his ignorance, he nodded gratefully to her words. "Just tell them," he instructed her. "Tell them I want to get off this ship and onto shore as swiftly as possible. I need a warm room with a good bed and fresh food and..." "Shush now, you'll tire yourself. Let me serve you in this. I won't be gone long, I promise you." That, at least, was true. She meant to make all haste. So there we can see a little bit of her being like, "Oh, they're just sailors." Ha ha ha. Twirl my mustache. Don't worry about them. Don't talk to them.
Wait until you get to the council, knowing full well this is the council members.
Right. So she says that she hopes to persuade the Bingtown ship to take only herself and the satrap to the town. There was no sense in having the others come along, and she wants her story told first.
Exactly.
And the most eloquently, so her story is believed above all others. And with the satrap alongside of her, she'll have that credibility.
Yes.
She wished, and she talks about how she's dressed today and says that she wished to appear imperious and yet somber. So she had chosen her clothes with care, insisted on time in which to dress her hair. And in addition to the subtle jewelry she wore, the toes of her slippers were heavy with several pairs of the satrap's best earrings. Whatever became of her, she did not intend to begin anew in poverty. So she once again raided the jewelry, stashed some on her person, just in case she was staying and going immediately to shore.
And good on her. She has a plan and she is executing it.
Yep. And here she is ignoring the Chalcedian captain who stood scowling nearby. So she's doing her best to ignore everything. She's like, this is my time. It's all in motion. It relies on me playing my part now.
Right. And there is a space of water between the ship that they're on and the live ships before them. I'm wondering how much distance. It's enough so that they can hear each other rail to rail, although
I guess like
shouting.
50 feet.
Yeah.
You know, probably not like that much.
I get, but it'd have to be pretty far because ships are really big. And so you'd want to make sure that they were far enough where they wouldn't crash, right?
Sure.
And I assume that it wouldn't be. Yeah. I assume that it wouldn't be like so bad that they would worry about somebody coming aboard the ship, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
I don't know. So anyway, they are staring each other down, including the figurehead of the live ship who moves to cross his arms while glaring at Cirilla, and she's so excited. She's
a live ship, a real live ship.
Yeah, she has never seen a live ship in the flesh, so to speak. And now she gets to see one in person. This is a real live ship.
And beside her, the Chalcedian crewmen muttered and several made their hand signs they believed would ward off magic. Their superstitious dread made her stronger. She harbored no such fears. Drawing herself up to her full height, she took a deep breath and pitched her voice to Carrie. I am Cirilla, heart companion to the Magnadon satrap Cosgo. My area of expertise is Bingtown and its history. He chose me to accompany him here. Now, weakened by illness and in sore distress, he chooses me to come to you and present you with his greetings. Will you send a boat for me? Of course we shall, a portly man in a wide yellow vest declared, but a bearded man shook his head. Quiet, Restart. You're only here on my sufferance. You, companion, you say you will come to us. You alone? I alone, to make known to you the satrap's will. I am a woman and unarmed. Will you let me cross to you and hear my words? There has been a great misunderstanding here. So this is where Devad Restart is on, and it just so happens to be the boat right in front of the satrap. So he got lucky there, I guess, out of all the live ships that kind of left.
Yeah. Although, I don't know, it feels like they would have to have appointed somebody ahead of time as the one talking for them, right?
Yeah, quite possibly.
He probably just picked whoever that was to come along.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which also, how did he convince this person who clearly does not seem to like him to allow him aboard? I don't know.
Weasel his way into any place.
Right. And true. So Cirilla then is waiting to see what the outcome is. She's watching them kind of talk it over with each other. She thinks about how the worst that could happen is that she becomes their hostage, and even that would get her off this hellish ship. So she's kind of just thinking there's no losses for her at this point. She would love to be able to get on the ship.
Yeah. And the bearded man comes back to the railing. He points at the captain, said, send her across in your boat. Two sailors at the oars, no more. The captain actually glanced at her before he looked at the satrap. It sent a small shiver of triumph through her. Did her rapist finally realize that she had taken a share of power for herself? She cautioned herself to discretion and cast her eyes down. For the first time, her hatred of him was the equal of her fear. Someday, she thought, I might be strong enough to kill you. So she's finally kind of realizing that, yes, people are aware that she's what she's doing and knows that she's the one kind of in control of this situation,
right,
on the satrap's side. But once things are declared and settled, it kind of happens really quickly. She's in a boat. She's rowed over and then lifted aboard onto the deck. The most frightening part of the episode was having to stand up in the boat. As a wave lifted the little tiny vessel within reach, the sailor leaned out and scooped her into an arm like a cat snatching a mouse from it under a cupboard. He said not a word, nor did he allow her time to feel more secure before he dashed up the ladder with her. And she gets on deck, and for a moment her ears roared and her heard thundered so that she could scarcely heard the introductions the bearded man was barking at her.
Right. I do just want to point out that that means that there was a sailor on the live ship that was waiting for her to come, went down the ladder alone, and then carried her in one arm, go and went back up the ladder.
Yeah.
That's so much strength that you would have to have and insane to think about. Also, how do you climb a ladder with one arm?
I feel like he kind of balanced her over the shoulder and then like held on with one hand, you know.
But she says that he goes pretty fast, which is pretty impressive if you ask me.
A silence falls, And Cirilla is kind of realizing, like, oh, now it's my turn, I guess. She says, it was suddenly daunting to stand there in the middle of a group of strange men on the deck of a live ship. Suddenly, Jamelia was so far away, it almost didn't exist. She willed it back to reality with her words. So she's assuming her part now. She is the heart companion, introduces herself once again, and says that the satrap is here to hear your grievances and solve them.
Right.
On the journey here, he was taken gravely ill, along with many of his party. When he realized how sick he was becoming, he took steps to assure that his mission would be completed successfully, no matter what became of him. So she reaches inside her pocket, pulls out the scroll that she wrote and had him sign that gives her power.
Mm-hmm.
She says, in this document, he appoints me as his envoy in residence to the Bingtown traders. I am authorized to speak for him. Several of the men looked incredulous. She decided to risk it all rather than not have them take her seriously. She opened her eyes wide and looked at the bearded man beseechingly. She lowered her voice as if she feared the Chalcedonians might hear. Please, I believe the satrap's life is in danger, as does he. Think on it. Would he ever have ceded so much power to me if he thought he was going to reach shore alive? If it is at all possible, we must get him off the Chalcedonian ship and to safety of Bingtown. She glanced fearfully back at the Chalcedonian ship. So she's really hamming up the part here, just like, and she does say, I'm going to lay it all bare. I'm going to put everything on the table.
Right.
What she says is the truth as she knows it. But it is a hammed up performance here. It is a like, hey, I want this to go my way exactly how I want. And I'll tell you the truth as much as I know, because that'll help me get it there.
Right. And I think it's really brilliant of her to recognize that the best strategy for it is to play damsel in distress.
Yes. And the captain's like, yeah, say no more. Because the rest of the words that you have to say should be brought before the council first.
Right.
Everyone should hear it. And we'll send a boat for him. Do you think they'll allow him to leave? And the captain's like, I warn you, lady, there are many in Bingtown who will consider this but a ploy to get into our good graces. Feelings for the satrapy have run foul of late. For you have not. Please, Traitor Cairn. And this is Roed Cairn's father.
Mm-hmm.
You are distressing our guest. This is Davod speaking here. My lady companion, please allow me. I shall be proud to extend the satrap the hospitality of Restart Hall. Although we traders may seem a bit divided at the moment, I am sure that you shall find that the hospitality of Bingtown lives up to its legendary standards. For now, let us get you off this windy deck and into the captain's sitting room. Come along, fear nothing. Traitor Cairn will set off a boat for the satrap. You shall have a hot cup of tea and tell us all about your adventures. There was something almost comforting in the broad man's assumption that she was a helpless, trusting female. She set her hand atop his forearm and allowed him to escort her away.
Ah, Davod. Weird.
And he weasels his way into everything, and it works, even though everyone knows he's so rude and not
slimy.
Tactful.
Yeah. And yet she seems to kind of like him. She's like,
I think because it's getting exactly what she wants.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is like a role that she can fill comfortably.
Mm.
I don't think she likes this role at all.
No, not definitely.
But it's
not
a role that she can fill comfortably because she's seen it so often around Jamelia.
Right. And I mean, to be fair, I think when you are in a situation like that, you would want to just kind of play up to the assumptions of the people.
You want somebody else to take control for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You're finally feeling like, okay, I'm off that ship where everything happened. I'm away from the captain.
Right.
Somebody else is in control, but like I made this situation happen. So I'm safe for now.
Right.
Lead me away.
Right. No, and I do think, I don't know, maybe I'm just a bad person, but I've definitely had the experience of knowing that things will get done a lot quicker if I just play to the expectations of the people around me.
Right.
And especially that like helpless female role of like, oh no, I'm a damsel, like help. Sometimes it works, you know, sometimes it gets you what you need so that you can get out of a place faster. And I get it with her being like, this will work, I'm gonna do this. And it does work. She gets what she wants.
Yeah.
Well, mostly.
Yeah, mostly. I mean, the part is playing how she planned it.
Right.
And it's going well for her, which is a very good thing. because in the scope of things, the Chalcedians are the bad guys in this trilogy.
Yeah. And honestly, to her too, I'm sure, I don't know if she had real strong thoughts about this before, but at least now she is also pro Bingtown, anti Chalcedians.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, an interesting chapter on the whole. We get a lot of things happening all at once. Paragon just left a couple chapters ago.
Really
get,
just missed everything.
Yeah, exactly. We get Rain and Greg coming back to Bingtown. Mm-hmm. They don't even know what's going on in Bingtown.
They're in for a nice surprise for Greg.
Yeah, they're talking about separating from Jamalia still when Jamalia has come to them.
Uh-huh.
And then there's like more than 10 Chalcedian warships in their harbor still.
Yeah, I did really like that Greg kind of leaves the interaction like, well, the war is going to happen soon, I'm sure, whatever. And it's literally going to happen soon. It's on your doorstep.
So we're getting kind of close to the end. I think you have a bookmark in there. We probably have 5-6 more chapters. Do you know the last one?
Let me check.
We're getting close to the end. Everything's kind of ramping up a bit here. And can't wait for the climax of this book.
Chapter 40 is last. So we have 10 chapters.
Oh, wow. All right. A lot longer than I thought then.
We're on page 622 in my copy. Like, we just finished on page 622. And the very last page is 850.
Okay. So we got 200 pages left.
Yeah.
10 chapters, 200 pages, each about 20 pages. Okay. That's about like the going rate for chapters for Robin Hobb.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get like a 30-page chapter.
True.
And that it's a tough one.
But I will say, the back of my book, because I'm now looking through, has a little thing where you can write in, send this in to get a copy of the Farseer trilogy. Nice. And it has prices even listed. You can get Assassin's Apprentice. I assume it's soft cover and then hardcover because it's one price slash another.
Yeah.
But $6.99 for soft cover, $9.99 for hardcover.
Oh, it's probably US and Canadian.
You think so?
I feel like that's on the back of a lot of US edition books. Could be hardcover, but I guess depending on when it's published, but hardcover for $10.
Says, please send me the books I've checked above. I'm including or enclosing blank $. Add $2.50 to cover postage and handling. Send check or money order. No cash or CODs, please.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Fun. All right. Well, thank you so much for tuning into this chapter. If you have thoughts on it, please let us know. You can always email us at isfitshappy@gmail.com, or you can find us at any of our social medias where we're always reading all of your comments, all of your messages, everything that you kind of post at us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, YouTube.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing from you.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
See you next week. Okay, so this time we don't have anything that a listener has brought to our attention, but we did have something that I wanted to bring up because I saw it on the Facebook page Robin Hobb Fans Unrestricted Chat, which if you're not part of that Facebook group and you have Facebook, you should join it.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, although I do know some of our listeners already are on there because I recognize your pictures and names whenever you post. And I'm like, oh, I feel like a creep. I know this person. They don't know me. Anyway, I don't believe this person is a fan of ours. If they are, they have not written in. But they have posted on the page about a theory that, and this is for a theory about Fitz specifically. So it doesn't really fit in
Assassin's Apprentice specifically.
Yes, it doesn't really fit in with the books we're currently reading, but it was such a good theory that I had to bring it to the podcast to talk about because I want all of you to hear about it and let us know your thoughts. But this fan wrote on the Facebook page talking about how they believe that Fitz may have been or may have had his mind wiped by Shrewd.
Yeah.
Not mind, I guess his memory of his mother.
Yeah. So Stephanie writes in and says, My theory is that, yes, Shrew did erase Fitz's memories of his mother to make sure he never had any divided loyalties. When Chade dies and joins the skill stream, he finds this out, and he and Verity and Shrewd make it their mission to give Fitz his memories back. There's even a line that Chade says in the skill stream, something around the lines of, "Fitz, come join us. I've learned so much. I want you to show you all I have discovered." The first time reading this, I assumed Chade was talking about the skill and what he has learned of the magic, but now I think he meant what he found out from Shrewd about Fitz's mother and his lost memories. So while Fitz is in the skill pillar, Shrewd restores his memory of his mother, which explains the sudden recollection he has to put into the wolf. So it's kind of like a combo of everything. Stephanie describes a bunch of stuff early on, and that's kind of like the sum up.
Right. Mm-hmm. Specifically, Stephanie talks about how in the very first scene we get with Fitz, he can't remember his mom at all. And he talks about how his grandfather, he remembers his grandfather talking to his mother at
and remembers the voice.
Yes. He remembers his grandfather throwing a snowball or snow or whatever at his mother. But when he turns around, he doesn't see anything there.
Right.
Which is weird. And I'm pretty sure talked about it in the very first chapter.
Yeah.
But also, just like an odd thing to note, because why would he have thrown snow if nobody was there? Why would Fitz have heard the voice of his mom begging him? And I think we may have said maybe he's remembering things a little time jumbled of his mom not being there. Who knows?
Yeah, and we were talking about, I know we talked about this in the first book's episodes, that Fitz is looking back on this time after the end of the trilogy when he has partially forged himself by putting memories into Girl on a Dragon.
Right.
So we were looking at it from a perspective of he put his own hurt and pain of being abandoned by his mother into there, and that's why he doesn't remember. But this is another theory about that.
Right. And Stephanie also goes on to say that it would explain why Fitz has this overwhelming sense of not being enough and not being whole. And because we know whenever he puts other parts of himself into the Girl on Dragon, he ends up feeling different and kind of not whole. And so that could kind of explain it. However, I don't know if I'm fully on board with that part of Stephanie's description, but overall, I love this theory. Yeah. I think it's really good. I think it's fun.
Stephanie also talks about the instance when the crazy lunatic in the market screaming Kepit at him, which that's Fitz's name from the Mountain Kingdom. It's Kepit. And we know that's probably his mother and grandmother in there or something, his mother at least. He doesn't recognize her at all. There's no hint of recognition. So that's Stephanie's kind of pointing to that as another influence of that memory alteration. And we've talked about before Shrewd having that moment of altering Fitz's mind to be more loyal to him when he's, what, 8 or 9 in the halls and he meets him with Regal there.
Right.
And asks him and first gives him the pin. So I'm guessing that would be the same moment. Stephanie doesn't remark exactly when.
No.
But Stephanie does say that Shrewd could have done this to have undivided loyalties.
Right.
Just get rid of the mother and then it's only the Farseer side. And then forever after, Fitz will be loyal to the Farseers.
Yeah. I think the only thing that you could argue about this not making sense is why wouldn't he also get rid of the memory of the grandfather?
Right.
However, the grandfather did bring him in. So I guess maybe there's a thought that
it could be like a quick thing too. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't there that long.
Yes. Yeah. Also, so later, this is all brought about, I think, because of the scene where Fitz is in the marketplace and hears somebody call out Kepit, which we know is his name and he remembers later. I thought it was really interesting that in that marketplace, there is an elderly woman with who is, we assume, Fitz's mom, which would have to be his grandma, right?
That's why I said potentially.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So why wouldn't he remember her either? Mm-hmm. And so again, if his mom's side of the family is all kind of wiped out.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. So Stephanie kind of goes on to say that when he does get the memories of his mother back from the skill pillar, Stephanie thinks it was, you know, Chade who finally found it, gave him back to him, or whatever the collective mm-hmm. Farseers that were dead finally decided, like, yeah, we need to give him everything back.
Right.
He comes out whole. He has the memories of his mother. And Stephanie believes that Fitz would not have been able to finish his wolf without those mother's memories. So it kind of all comes together at the end because he's then able to put the memories of his mother into the wolf.
Right.
So yeah, very cool.
Yeah. Very hard to know.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, unless Robin Hobb herself decides to comment, we will not know.
But yeah, I like the theory. I don't love it. I still ascribe to the fact that he kind of partially forged himself. And when Fool gives the memories back at the end of Tawny Man, he kind of has some of those emotional responses again. I'll have to be on the lookout for when he fully remembers his mother's
and
stuff.
And I guess, I mean, to be fair, why would he need to think on his mother? Why would he tell us about the story again?
Right, yeah.
Because he's already told the story. But I think what we really need to do is figure out when he tells the Fool that his real name is Kepit. Because I think that would give us a better idea, because he would remember that as his real name probably if he had the memory of his mom, right? You would think. I don't know. I guess I just feel like that would be a really good indicator.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I guess thank you, Stephanie, if you are a listener. If not, still thank you for giving that theory out into the world where we were able to see it and talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it's a magical theory about something that could literally just be trauma.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's a very interesting thing. So thank you very much.
And on that note, I also wanted to talk about another post that was same Facebook group, Robin Hobb fans, unrestricted chat, by Jude, who talks about how Kepit means beloved in Old English. And
interesting.
I thought that was also really cute that Kepit and beloved share a name. I don't know. Very cute, very whole circle-y, two halves of the same coin sort of deal. But also came to mind as we were talking so much about Fitz's remembrance or lack thereof of his mother and his name.
Thank you so much for those thoughts. If you guys are listening,
if not, you know, whatever, our listeners, please feel free to write in and tell us your thoughts on those ideas and any other ideas you might have. We always love hearing from you guys. See you next week.